Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Sinab Zila Hickey. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin by listening in on a public safety committee in which concerns for inherent and systemic racism in police trainings were voiced. Then for this week's Labor Bucket, we have an interview with Adam Peltier, the new president of Troy Area Labor Council. Later on, early voting begins this weekend, and we have an interview with Cheryl Kennedy, who is running for a Troy City Council seat to represent District 6. After that, we have the second part of our interview with Utica resident and Burmese revolutionary activist Zhao Nang Nguyen. Finally, we hear about the locally created Mooncatcher Project, which provides reusable, washable menstrual products to thousands of menstruating young people. But first, here are the headlines. The Times Union reports that Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is, quote, preparing to ease border restrictions for fully vaccinated travelers. Travelers would still be tested for the virus, but that the current 14-day quarantine requirements likely would be eased. The Record reports that longtime Unity House Chief Executive Officer Chris Burke has announced that he will retire from his role in mid-2022. Only the second CEO in the organization's 50-year history, he's led the organization for more than 30 years. The Rensselaer Board of Elections is appealing a court order to provide an early voting site in central Troy. The court ruled in a lawsuit filed by the state attorney general that the board's decision not to place a site in the centrally located area within Troy is arbitrary and capricious. Presently, Rensselaer County boasts three early voting locations, Skodak Town Hall, Brunswick Office Building, and the Holy Cross Armenian Church. Advocates claim that the latter is not as accessible for those who live on the western edge of the city from neighbors including Lansingburg, North Central, Hillside, South Troy, many of whom are low income and people of color. Under pressure from local leaders and insurance executives, New York Democratic Party leaders are blocking a vote on universal health care legislation, even though it has majority support in the legislature. The New York City Municipal Labor Committee, under pressure from the New York City teachers, argues unions have sacrificed wage increases in the past in order to bargain for better health care coverage and lower costs, and forcing them to switch to a single-payer system, which would make the past work a waste. Historically, opposition from labor unions nationwide to single-payer legislation has been a barrier to reform. Large unions often get employers to pay into a welfare and health fund, which is a source of patronage for the union to hire workers, to administrator and various benefit programs. The state legislature is expected to pass a law to require boards of election to start counting absentee, military, and special ballots on a rolling basis as soon as they're received. Presently, New York is often the last in the county to complete counting votes as it waits until well after Election Day to start counting such ballots. Election workers would have 4 days to review ballots and place them into one of three categories: valid, invalid, and, quote, defective but curable. The bill sets up rules for how election commissioners would handle valid ballots and says ballots are presumed valid if commissioners are split. That's it for the headlines. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390. We begin with a segment from a recent public safety committee in which Albany Community Police Review Board Chair Nairobi Vives Esquire addressed what she saw as inherent and systemic racism in police training. Paul Smart brings us this report.
Nairobi Vives, the chair of Albany's Community Police Review Board, recently addressed the city's Public Safety Committee of the Common Council about an apparently racist slant uncovered in police academy training that she and other CPRB members attended.
Basically, the night in question, I went to the CPA class, and the presenter was Detective Lieutenant Schechter. And during his presentation, as I put in my letter, he made a few comments that were, I felt, insensitive or what have you throughout his presentation, but it culminated in the incident that really was offensive and racist, talking about black on black crime, and specifically that black people don't care about their community. And we engaged in sort of a back and forth from there. And then following that, after I let other members of the CPRB know what had happened, I found out that the same presenter had made similar comments in the past, and board members had complained then, and it seemingly nothing had happened except for a private apology and not by Detective Lieutenant Schechter himself.
And my first inclination when we got the letter from you all was to try to let this complaint run its course, because there is an active complaint with Sergeant Mahar. It's Sergeant, right?
Yes.
Are you running the training?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Okay. Okay. So let me start with the commander first. He outranks you. So
certainly,
commander.
All I'm prepared to comment on tonight is this is an active investigation. We started this several weeks ago. It wasn't too long, I don't know the exact date in front of me, but it wasn't too long after we received Ms. Vives' feedback on her experience. And my office quickly reacted by opening up an investigation into the matter. So,
any committee members have any questions or concerns or comments they want to put out there? Oh, Mr. Hoey.
Yeah, I was very concerned about the letter. And, you know, what I learned in sexual harassment training, that if somebody feels uncomfortable, it should be addressed. So I'm glad that we're having this meeting. The one question I have for Ms. Vett, the Chair Vives, is do you think that the academy training for the CR, for the committee, is worthwhile or not? My own feeling is it is worthwhile, but if we can improve it, is it something that we should continue, or do you think it's not worth doing?
I think that with changes, it would be worthwhile. That's why we put in our letter that we wanted to be relieved of the requirement to have to continue the class as it is in this manner. I don't feel comfortable going back, and I haven't been back. And I understand that it is a requirement under the city code that CPRB members and our monitors do so. And I have no problem with following that requirement. But my concern is that letting behavior like that go unchecked and allowing for members of the of APD, and I don't mean to put his behavior on all the members of APD. So I just want to be clear with my statement. But this having happened previously with the same person and happening again, it's very concerning because, like, it's just known that people see the police in a position of power because they are. And to stand before this group of citizens, you know, some of the people that are there are not required to be there as we are. They come out of interest. For him to stand there and to make these statements in his official capacity and from a position of power was just inappropriate to me in many ways and untrue. And in our back and forth, I was just asking him to stop saying that, to revise your statement, and it didn't happen. So going back to what you originally asked, I did get some things from the class and with other presenters. I think I put this in the letter too, that, you know, they exhibited professionalism. And when we had critiques, myself and others, they said they were, you know, they were taking them back. And I think that was some tweaking and making the class a little bit more objective, and especially making it free from like racist ideas that, you know, at least one person shared. I think that it would be great. And part of our mission, I say all the time, it's written into the code, we want to repair the relationship. And I think this is one way to do it. It is one way for APD to show different sides of itself. But I just think that there needs to be some tweaks. And what we suggested was, you know, maybe an outside consultant and in addition, recording of the classes so that if there are incidences that come up or things that need to be reviewed, that can happen.
Sergeant Mahar, can you just a quick overview of the academy, things taught, the Citizens
Police Academy? Absolutely. It's a 14-week curriculum. We're trying to get every subject or division or function that we do as a police department. It's about a 3-hour class each Wednesday night. Sometimes it's a little bit less, sometimes a little bit more. I know I've had good feedback from all the participants, including Ms. Vives. We've had good conversations. I had a good conversation with Melody a few times. So it's been eye-opening for me as well.
I mean, there's an ongoing investigation. We'd like to be kept apprised of that. Commander, I would ask that any correspondence or communications you have with Ms. Vives regarding the complaint, maybe you include me on them. Are you okay with that, Ms. Vives? If it's sure. Emails or can you keep me in that loop so I can see where we're at? And we look forward to a resolution, a healthy and peaceful resolution to this. We want obviously our board members participating in this academy, but this kind of back and forth that led us to be here today is problematic. We'll get that taken care of.
I can just say one last thing. I don't think, just to echo what I said before, this doesn't have to be a throw the baby out with the bathwater situation. This dialogue right here that is looking, you know, taking this complaint seriously and looking to make changes so that, like, I don't know which council member said it, maybe Councilman Ballarin, that everyone is comfortable and the class works for everyone. But we did have some experiences where I made comments or someone else in the class made comments that I thought might be not received well, and was received very well by members of APD, and started a very nice dialogue. And there was, you know, understanding from their side on different issues. Like we talked about like police discretion and like issuing tickets, and how you could see it from the citizen side. Or we talked about training, and maybe more training is needed. And there were some hot, like maybe harder to digest issues that were talked about in a very like good and respectful way on both sides. And I thought I was, you know, not surprised, but I was happy, you know, that this was a forum that this could happen. And so I think that it could be And from what I'm hearing in the past, people have liked it, but I also know that in the past there was criticism, and the same criticism that I brought up. So I am very happy that this piece will be taken care of so that everyone can come, hopefully, and everyone can dialogue, and there can be this building of trust, and it can be this fruitful dialogue that I was able to participate in some of the classes. So I'm not advocating for doing away with it forever. I'm advocating for, and I think which everyone understands, fixing it so that it can be even better than it was, and that people don't have the same experience that I have from this and that particular class. But thank you, everyone.
Change is slow. We'll see how this discussion fits in with talk about a new public safety initiative for the city of Albany. This has been Paul Smart for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
In that report, we heard Albany Community Police Review Board Chair Nairobi Vives Esquire speaking at a public safety committee. On June 9th, 2021, Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry interviewed Adam Peltier, the new president of Troy Area Labor Council. In this part one labor segment, we will hear about his new position and thoughts on the future of the Troy Area Labor Council.
This is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And this is Labor Talk. And today I have on the telephone my guest, Adam Peltier, who's the new president of the Troy Area Labor Council. And how you doing, Adam?
I'm doing good, Willie. Thanks for having me on this morning.
All right, no problem. Probably going to have you on more than this. So, Adam, first of all, before we, get in deep into the questions, what is the Troy Area Labor Council for people, that don't really know about it? You know, what it is and what do they do?
All right. So the Troy Area Labor Council, at least as I understand it, is one of around 500 state and local labor councils of the AFL-CIO. It's one of the few places where delegates and members from different locals from different industries can kind of come together, share their situation, what's going on, and we try to essentially figure out ways that we may be able to assist or support however we might be able to. And ours, the Troy Area Labor Council, we represent about 10,000 people in Troy and Rensselaer County, which is approximately 5% of the entire county population of almost 160,000. So we've got members who work in a variety of different places, school teachers, mm-hmm. school support staff, custodial workers, healthcare, social security employees, communication specialists, engineers, all kinds of building trades, childcare, pretty much almost one of every kind of worker.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, so you represent a variety of workers in Troy. So Troy has a state in the Labor Council, right?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So Adam, so to get started, tell me about your labor activism and how it brought you to this point in your life,
So for me, actually, it's funny. I think that one of the reasons that I got active in the labor movement was because of the Troy Area Labor Council. So, one night I was over at my cousin's house talking about some stuff that was going on at work, at both the employer and the union side. And this gentleman just said, you should think about starting to come to the Troy Area Labor Council meetings so you can, find out you're not alone or living on an island. So I started attending Troy Area Labor Council meetings probably 6 or 7 years ago at this point. And that was basically an opportunity for me to meet and interact with members of other unions outside of the one that I'm a member of, which is AFGE Local 3343. They represent Social Security employees all over the state. So it was just nice to be exposed to different ideas and people that were not necessarily from my own union. So it was an opportunity to kind of get out of a little bit of a mode of groupthink. And I think it really helped. And that was sort of, you know, a springboard. And through the Troy Area Labor Council, it also kind of got me involved in other social and economic issues. So, I mean, my history and you know, kind of what brought me into labor activism, I think the ultimate cause would actually be the Troy Area Labor Council. And I think that that's true of some of our other younger, newer delegates as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Adam, you are a Risler County resident, and were you born in Risler County?
Nope. I was born actually out in out near Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.
Oh, Canada. Actually.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I ended up growing up primarily up in Franklin County, New York. Mm-hmm. It's a town called Chateauguay. Mm-hmm. It's no one's really ever heard of, but it's between Plattsburgh and Potsdam. Mm-hmm.
So were any of your family ever active? You know, because I mean, it had to be something that pushed you. I know Detroit Labor, you said Detroit Labor Council was one of your springboards, but were there any early activism in your life?
No, I don't really think so. You know, I'm not one of those people that's able to say, you know, I got involved in the labor movement because I grew up in a union household. That just wasn't my experience. I always have had a bit of a anti-authoritarian streak in me, and mm-hmm. I think that labor activism provides a healthy outlet for that personality trait or defect.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Adam, now you're the new president of the Troy Area Labor Council, which is an awesome responsibility. So I know you have to give it some thought to be that. So what are some of your expectations of the Troy Area Labor Council over the next few years?
Well, yeah, I was just sworn in at our May meeting, and it's been quite busy on a couple different fronts. but I think that my primary goals or expectations over the next few years is to hopefully increase the number of people that are coming to our meetings from new places that we haven't we don't have delegates from yet. So I hope that our Troy Area Labor Council continues to do a lot of the stuff that it has been doing, which is to be active on obviously labor issues, but also issues that may exist but are connected to labor and the social and economic. So like things like housing, justice, health insurance. These are things that are both labor union issues, but also issues that affect working people everywhere, whether or not they're union members. So I hope that we're able to bring more folks together, coalesce around a lot of the areas of common concern that might not be the primary concern of the individual affiliate unions that are affiliated with the Troy Area Labor Council, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No. So, Adam, you're one of the, I think, youngest presidents of a labor council. But I want to ask you also the question, too, you know, being young, what motivates you, you know, when you wake up in the morning, every morning, to say, hey, I got to get involved in the labor movement struggles?
Boy, that's a tough one.
Right?
I think
is it because you care about social justice? Or?
Yeah. That's a part of it. So, I mean, I think the thing that keeps me going on the, you know, with labor issues and labor activism is ultimately it's something that I view as a force for good that has the ability to, you know, change not just working conditions, but especially in New York, you know, some of the unions that exist have a tremendous amount of power with things within the legislature. So it's just, I think, eternally an optimist. And I think obviously labor unions are a force for good. And then there's also the boss aspect. There's always some boss out there somewhere trying to do whatever they can to get one over on their workers. And the only thing that really stands in the way of that happening is unions. So it's just I don't want to frame it as a battle between, you know, good and bad, but to some extent I do. And I think that belonging on the side of labor is me being on the side of the good.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry interviewing Adam Peltier, the new president of Troy Area Labor Council. For those just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary. Cheryl Kennedy is running for Troy City Council seat to represent District 6. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey talked with Cheryl about why she's running, what her priorities will be should she win the seat, and her position on a number of issues facing the city. Cheryl has the nomination of Democratic Party leaders, but is being challenged by Marquetta Edwards for the Democratic Party line.
Cheryl, thank you so much for taking a moment to talk to me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You are running to represent District 6 on Troy's City Council. Can you tell me what prompted your run for this office?
I have lived in the city of Troy for about 15 years. I have been in my neighborhood for 15 years as well. I have a daughter that goes to Troy Public School, and I've done a considerable amount of work as the former economic development coordinator for the city of Troy. I worked in planning and economic development, and also considerable experience in nonprofit work in the city of Troy and in a variety of different projects. And I have the realization that it's very easy to be critical of the people who represent you without really understanding the bureaucracy involved with making change. And I thought it was time to put my money where my mouth is.
Can you tell me about District 6?
Sure. So District 6, South Troy, the southiest of South Troy, is one of the major entries into the city. I don't think it receives nearly enough attention or investment. You know, we have great neighborhoods with very distinct personalities, businesses that have been mainstays in Troy for many, many years, places like South Troy Diner, Carol's Place, Inferno, Kennedy's Tavern, Franklin Terrace Ballroom, and hidden environmental gems like the Burden Pond Preserve and the Vanderheiden Reserve. And with that, back to us being a main entry of the city, according to DOT, we're the second most trafficked bridge in Troy. And I just think there should be more value placed on us. We see that we were an industrial center, you know, for Troy in the 19th century. That's why we have all this great housing stock. But we've had a lot of disinvestment, and I would like to see that change.
Should you win this race, you then face a challenge in the general election. If you're successful, what do you want to dig your teeth into first?
I would like to really look at South Troy's working waterfront. We have a working waterfront plan that has a lot of potential. You know, I think the companies utilizing it in partnership with the municipal government could really, you know, make a change to the way that waterfront works and how accessible it is to the people in the community. And just because it's an industrial area doesn't mean that it has to be an eyesore and that the people, you know, who live in South Troy, you know, can't access that water like the people in downtown can access their waterfront. So I think people always find a way to the water, no matter if it's called a brownfield or not. And therefore, we should strive to make sure that is safe and accessible. Also, if I can just mention number two of what I would like to dig my teeth into is to create more civic engagement opportunities for the students that we have in Troy. You know, we're the youngest community in the Capital Region. I grew up in Utica and went to Proctor High School. We had this great program where I was able to become a legislative intern for a term. And it really opened my eyes to how the local government functions. And I think these types of programs are especially productive to low-income students, which I was. That was important to me because I got the understanding of the external forces that were impacting my community and my life and how to use the system to impact meaningful change.
Right now, the district is represented by Eileen McDermott. Can you tell me why you think a change is needed?
Eileen's actually the treasurer of my campaign, so it's been great to have her backing in my campaign and her support as I've moved forward and the understanding of the priorities that she's been working on in the past few years. You know, I think change is always necessary, though. You know, we recently reduced the amount of terms that a city council person can serve. I think they can serve up to 3 2-year terms. And I think that's important. You know, you don't want the same people sitting on a city council for 20 or 24 years because you'll have, you know, the same ideas. I'm especially interested in seeing younger people and people of color in government and engaged more fully in the community. You know, I don't want to see the same 100 people at the charrette that I used to attend when I worked at City Hall. I would like to see more people engaging and, you know, telling us what they need because we are civil servants and that means a great deal to me.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Cheryl Kennedy. Cheryl is a candidate for Troy City Council in District 6.
After the murder of George Floyd last summer by former police officer Derek Chauvin, Governor Andrew Cuomo charged localities across the state with looking at their own police forces and working with community members to come up with reform plans. Troy's Police Reform and Reinvention Collaborative released its plan on April 1st, and it received a lot of criticism. The first action taken under that new plan was to hire 6 new police officers. Some argue that the many millions that went into these new hires could make our city safer by investing in youth and poverty programs. Where do you stand on the report and on the first action taken under it?
Good question. So yes, the PRRC has received much criticism, and I think a great deal of those criticisms are valid. This report could have been done better, but at this point, this is the report that we have. And I think that we need to look at the good recommendations and use them as a jumping off point. To create action, we have to take the good parts of it and start moving those forward.
Are there some pieces of the report that you want to pull out and highlight here as things that you would push to be priorities for the city?
I think so. So there's a review board that is part of the recommendations that I think should be a priority in the report as well, you know, and throughout the time, you know, there's talk about working with Khalil Jameson Consulting Group on working on internal change, which is a difficult thing. So I would like to see them start moving on that internal change and reporting back to us. I would like to see that be a more open process as well. And I'm not sure how that will happen. I'm not sure how that can happen right now with a certain amount of virtual meetings happening because of the pandemic. I think it's kind of hard to meet on neutral ground and have these difficult but very necessary discussions.
Do you think there's racism in the Troy Police Department?
So, yes, I think racism is inherent in every institution and system in America. It would be appropriate to acknowledge that. I'm hopeful that they're taking additional steps to not only address racism in our police department, but to instill anti-racist practices into training. I believe this change has to happen not only on a local level, but I think there needs to be some national legislation to move that forward. And I also believe that, you know, one of the recommendations of the NAACP is that police agencies without those policies, training, and databases shouldn't be able to receive grants and other funding. There needs to be an increase in that police accountability to include limits to funding if you're not doing the appropriate training.
I live in Lansingburg, and I have to admit, I'm a driver, but I've recently heard people talk about pedestrianizing downtown Troy. Do you know anything about that? And what are your thoughts about making downtown Troy more pedestrian friendly?
I think the entirety of the city should be more pedestrian friendly. And, you know, I walk my dog everywhere and I'm out campaigning right now and just noticing that there's a lack of extended sidewalk area for people who are walking. I live on Stowe Hill. You know, there's a big portion of sidewalk missing at the bottom. So you see, you know, moms with carriages having to like jump out on the road, you know, to get around this portion that is, you know, just like a dirt pile. And then, you know, you have cars, I'm on a dead end too. So you have cars coming up at like 30 or 40 miles an hour, which, you know, I don't think we need people driving over 20 miles an hour in a city. And, you know, speaking to downtown, I don't think we need people driving that fast in an urban core.
When you are not out knocking on doors and campaigning, Cheryl, what do you do for fun? Where can we find you relaxing in the area?
You can find me at home most of the time with my family, walking my dog. I do like to walk down in the industrial waterfront, which is why that is such an important topic to me, because it's, even though it's had so much disinvestment, it's still beautiful and it has so much potential. I hike the Narrows. I spend a lot of time with my neighbors. I think, you know, District 6 is really tremendous and we have everything that we need here. The only thing that I would add, and you didn't ask me this in the question, but I would like to see a grocery store somewhere between South Troy and South Central.
That makes sense. It seems like there's a bit of a food desert in that area. Where do people go to get their food? Are there bodegas there?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Capital Roots has a healthy foods program where they bring some fruit and vegetables to the different corner stores, but I don't think that's enough. And part of what I looked at when I was in economic development for the city was how do they decide where they're going to put, you know, the next Price Chopper? And why does it have to be such a suburban footprint every time they come to the capital region? Why can't we have something like they have in the city? They have a more, you know, metropolitan two-story compact grocery store, which I think is our issue. We don't have any large swaths of land for them to be able to build a 5-acre supermarket, but we have some smaller areas that, you know, we could modify a plan and do something smaller or have maybe an independent grocery take up residence.
Well, Cheryl, thank you so much for talking to me. Stay safe out there on the campaign trail.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey speaking with Cheryl Kennedy, who is running for a Troy City Council seat to represent District 6. Early voting for the Democratic primary begins Saturday, June 12th. Utica resident and Burmese revolutionary activist Zhao Nang Nguyen sat down with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Brendan Maslaukas Dunn to speak about the refugee communities in Utica, the current military coup and political crisis in his home country, and the ongoing spring revolution that erupted. This is part two of a three-part interview.
So we're sitting now in Utica, New York, which has earned the nickname the City of Refugees over the years. There's a very large population of refugees from all over the world, but specifically Burma. Can you talk about what the population, the different peoples from Burma, what that looks like here, and what the City of Refugees means to you as someone that lives here?
I used to work at the refugee center as an interpreter and as the caseworker. The refugees started resettling in Utica in 1999, and then it started coming up all over refugees from Burma. Like, the Karen ethnics are the majority population in Utica. Then the second is Burmese Muslim, and then the rest are represented for each individual ethnic from Burma, such as Karenni, such as Arakanese, also called Rakhine, such as Kachin, and such as Kaya. And there are many different minority, also Mon, and what else? There are many diverse ethnic minorities coming to refugee to Utica. And as you said, yeah, refugee is also known as the town that loves refugees, which is recognized by Lutheran Immigration, LIRS. Yeah, they give a name Utica as a the town that loves refugees. Because this town is very valuable for refugees because they are truly welcome all refugees all over the world. And we can meet like many different refugees from all over the world, such as Bosnian, Palestinian, Iraqi, Yemeni, and Nepalese right now. And also is very famous in the world, like currently we call as a Rohingya from Burma, which is they start establishing in Utica a couple years ago. So yeah, it is a wonderful city that, you know, welcoming refugees until now, you know, since in the past. And also the refugee just start resettling, as I know it, almost 40 years already in here in Utica.
Talk more about the plight of the Rohingya people in Burma, the genocide, and you know, give some more context to that.
Rohingya is still exists in Burma, and they are oppressed by the military since in the past history in Burma, and each military are trying to play in political issues. They use Rohingya always when they when people are requested to change in Burma. So they're trying to let people focus on many different issues. Those are military keep doing in Burma, especially we call Buddhist and Islam crisis. They always create that way. At that time, when they went to change, like tricking the political situation in Burma, they always create that kind of problem. And then in 2012, they start killing the Rohingya in Burma. Yeah, I also recognize that Rohingya people are it's a genocide, you know, by the military regime. Yeah, we also accept ethnic cleansing war for oppressing Rohingya, like genocide war for Rohingya. Yeah, I'm individually, as I agree, not only me, the whole Burma are suffering that the military has been doing them as a ethnic cleansing, like, what is it, human rights violation. I, by myself, individually, I have a great friend, Rohingya, back in Burma. I met him when I was in 8th grade. Yeah, he fled from that area and paid, I don't know how many thousand in the Burmese currency to get free from his state to move to capital of Burma. Then, since then, I know about Rohingya exists in Burma. I also learned from like our Burma history from different books not written by the military group. So yeah, I accept the Rohingya, and they are also human being, and they are one of the ethnic minority group from Burma.
One thing I've noticed in following the events as they unfold in Burma is all the different ethnic groups, the different communities, the unity that they've expressed in these mass protests in the revolution. And also, I've noticed more and more people speaking out against the plight, you know, the exploitation and oppression of Rohingya people specifically, but other people too. Can you talk a little more maybe about the, you know, the significance of this current revolution in uniting all these different ethnic and religious groups?
Yeah, we always call revolution, but it might be, you know, strange to other community for this one, because we, as a Burmese, we lost freedom since British colonized Burma for almost 20 years, 200 years. Then we got freedom from British in 1947. At the time, we had a democratic government for a couple of years, and then military seized power in 1962. Since then, the military are trying to breaking apart all ethnic minority. The military is always trying to break the unity in Burma. That is why military is always creating a problem between each group, like between Buddhists religion and Islamic religion, between Buddhist and Christian religion. The military is always creating this kind of problem, not to unite each ethnic groups. In every revolution we call in 1988, military created again Muslim and Buddhist problem, crisis. And then in 2010, 2007, every time the military is trying to break apart Burma, if we are united together, we can fight them back and we can win from like military oppression. It's same thing in every revolution we call. Like we had like 2007 Saffron Revolution, monks are protesting on the street, and then they fail because of unity. But in this time, we call 2021 Spring Revolution. People are learned from the history a lot. And also, thank God, like Facebook and social media are very strong in Burma these late days since Aung San Suu Kyi entered to government organization, government administration. Then Burma got had a chance to use cell phone, internet, Facebook, such social or media. Then the whole Burma, I can say, like a little bit advanced, you know, with technology.
This is part two of a three-part interview. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Brendan Maslauskas Dunn speaking with Utica resident and Burmese revolutionary activist Zhao Nang Nguyen. We end tonight with a story on the Mooncatcher Project. Founder and executive director Ellie Funwell-Tyme spoke with Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Bria Barthel about how a sewing project started in her Schenectady basement 12 years ago grew to provide reusable, washable menstrual products to thousands of girls in 29 countries, allowing them to stay in school and also become a source of economic development for women in many countries.
I'm Bria Barthel with Hudson Mohawk Magazine. And today I have the pleasure of talking with Ellie Van Welsheim about an incredible organization she started called Mooncatcher Project. Ellie, tell us a little bit about your project.
Thank you for having me. The Mooncatcher Project started about 12 years ago. It started because I became aware of the fact that young girls throughout the world were dropping out of school because of their period. They would lose a week of school every month, have no way of dealing with their period. And when they kept missing a week of school, this could add up to as many as 50 days a year. And that put them so far behind that they couldn't graduate with their class. They couldn't go back and redo the class. And so they would drop out. And when girls drop out of school in countries like Uganda or Kenya or in India, all over the world, parents will often marry them off to older men who are strangers to them, who get them pregnant. So you have girls, having little babies when they're still babies themselves. And I was horrified about this. I just couldn't even believe it. It's hard for me after all these years to realize that I had absolutely no awareness of this problem. I just assumed being an American, middle class woman that, you know, everybody has a way to buy tampons or pads or something. I mean, incredibly naive, incredibly privileged on my part. And I now know that there's many, many millions of girls and women who do not have access to supplies, and it interrupts their life.
So it's much more than an inconvenience, but very much not being able to control your menstruation or have the means of taking care of yourself has such a large political dimension to it. How did you go about supplying products for girls? And what do those products include?
Well, I wanted to make something that was reusable and washable. One of the things about the Mooncatcher Project is we're very environmentally conscientious. So I wanted to make something that wasn't going to add to the landfill throughout the world. I also knew that there wasn't garbage removal or pickup in most of these countries. These countries are very, very poor. And I didn't want to add to that problem as well. So I started to make a product that could be washed and dried and used over and over. I also was making something that you could wear without underwear, because one of the things that we found out is that many girls can't afford underwear. In a lot of these countries, that's a real luxury. When you're making less than $2 a day, spending money on underwear is not going to happen. That money is going to go towards food. It's going to go towards absolute essentials. So I had to figure out a way to keep this pad on. So I went through a lot of different designs, and I used my daughter to be the tester, because she is young enough to still be menstruating when I already wasn't, even when I started this. And we spent about a week testing this. She'd wear it. I'd look at her bloody pads. We would be deep in conversation about bunching or leaking or whatever. And then we'd look at each other and start laughing and realize that, you know, who does this? What mother-daughter does this? But we like to say that it's made, we've taken mother-daughter bonding to a whole new level.
And from that humble beginning, you've grown into an organization that now provides products to how many different girls in how many different countries?
Well, there's, I don't know how many girls. I mean, we keep track of these figures, but they change constantly. But there's thousands and thousands of girls that have gotten these. Last I counted, we're in 29 countries, which doesn't mean that our sewing cooperatives are in that many countries. Our sewing cooperatives are in Kenya, Uganda, Malawi, and India. Also have three sort of satellite sewing cooperatives in Nigeria, the Philippines, and in Haiti.
So when you talk about sewing cooperatives, are these a source of income for people participating in them? Is it also international financial development, community development?
What we wanted to do is to make sure that we not only were serving people in other countries, but that we were helping women in other countries make a living. That was really important to us. We didn't want to be yet another organization that just gave handouts. The women in our sewing cooperatives, they make the pads for us and we pay them. But along with that, their small sewing cooperatives own all the equipment that it takes to run a sewing room. So they've got machines and tables and chairs and thread and, you know, oil and everything you need to have a sewing center. So they do make kits for us, but they also use all of that equipment to find other jobs in their own countries so that they can bring in more income. So they are dependent on this work to help feed their families. And they've grown and they're expanding. Our place in Uganda is just building a whole new building because they were working out of a metal storage container and it was hot. And it was small, and they're now actually building a building that they've been raising money for. And we've been helping them raise some money as well. It's growing.
And this international program, getting involved in community development and activities in 59 nations, started in your house in Schenectady.
It did. At my dining room table. Yeah.
And I loved how you referred to yourself as you didn't realize you were going to become the menstrual queen.
Yes, I actually have people call me sometimes and say things like that to me, like, "Are you the menstrual lady?" And I just giggle because I really love it that people know me for that. But who would have thought? I mean, you know, years ago, if someone said this is what you're going to be doing with your life, I would have thought they were crazy. But yeah, I'm the menstrual queen. I'm proud of it.
Now, there's a couple pieces I want to touch on. First is, I'll confess, I got a bag of 25 kits to sew and I never finished sewing them. I was impressed to see the complexity that a kit includes. How many different items?
It has what we call a carrier, which is the part of the kit that holds the actual pad. And this carrier is worn between your legs and then tied around your waist, just like in the olden days. Anybody that's, probably over 50 might remember way back when they first started their period that we had these weird belts that we wore and you kind of clipped on a little Kotex pad thing. It's kind of similar to that idea, except that everything is washable and reusable. So there's the carrier, there's three pads that we give each girl, there's the belt, and then there's a waterproof bag that you can put your used pad into, and there's a drawstring bag that holds everything.
And you've had how many volunteers here helping you sew these kits about?
Well, all I know is that we have between 1,500 and 2,000 people on our mailing list. That doesn't mean they all help sew. But a normal moon bee, we do something called a moon bee where people in this area come together and they help make these kits. Now, they might sew, they might cut, they might measure, iron, pack, whatever. And we usually get about 40 people at each of those. We've gotten as many as 150 people. We've gotten fewer than 40 as well, but there's churches, synagogues, libraries, colleges, high schools, community centers, temples, all sorts of organizations that invite us in to do these. When COVID hit, we were doing as many as four or five a week. If you start thinking that there's 30, 40, 50 people in each of those every time, it's a lot of volunteers.
So unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I want to thank you. That's Ellie von Welsheim talking about the Mooncatcher Project, a program she started in her house in Schenectady that has expanded to being an international presence, both for financial development and for education for girls. In our next segment, we'll talk about other aspects of the program. Thanks, Ellie.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You just heard Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Bria Barthel speaking with Ellie von Welsheim about her Mooncatcher project. For more information on the project and how you can help, see mooncatcher.org. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, also your engineer. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice, produced by the community for the community, and is supported by independent donations. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all of the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org/stories, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.